What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
I'm Reshma Kapadia, Associate Editor at Barron's. Welcome to Barron's Live, Managing Your Money, How to Tweak Your Portfolio for a More Active Government. Today, we have Olga Biddle, who's a Global Equity Strategist at William Blair, to talk a little bit more about government policy and what it means for investors. Welcome, Olga.
Thank you, Reshma. Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, you know, there's so much to talk about. You know, DC has certainly been the center of activity lately with the showdown over raising the country's debt ceiling to make sure that we continue to, you know, stay current on our liabilities. And then there was the last minute move to kick the debt can down the road a couple months last week. And we're still seeing Congress wrangle over a bipartisan infrastructure package, a $3.5 trillion spending package that's central to President Biden's economic agenda. There's a lot in that package, everything from vision and dental care for seniors to help with child and health care to a range of climate-oriented measures. And of course, there's corporate tax increases to pay for some of the spending. This is usually the drama that I think long-term investors have long ignored. But it seems, Olga, like it's harder to not pay attention, not just to what's going on in DC now, but just more broadly to DC, you know, in terms of regulation or foreign policy. How are you thinking about this? You know, are we moving away from all eyes just on the Fed?
That's a really great question. And Reshma, if you permit me a 2-second detour, I actually want to start with away sort of from the drama, which hasn't been enacted yet, although obviously, you know, we all anticipate that some form of these measures will come to fruition eventually. Something usually does, right? I want to start with two items just from this past weekend that actually have already come to be. And the first one is, you know, last Friday, amazingly, 136 countries have come together and agreed on a 15% minimum corporate tax rate. So, you know, I'm talking about the OECD broker deal here. And there were only really four holdouts. And, you know, these are largely, if not exclusively, in Africa. So this is a U-turn, right, from 40 years of corporate tax policies where, you know, basically a large multinational could focus its energy on arbitraging one country's, you know, tax system against another to basically avoid any tax liability.
Yeah.
And the other point, you know, on a slightly happier note, you know, we received a couple of days ago the news of this year's Nobel Prize winners in economics, and it went to three separate groups of researchers for their application of natural experiment to labor economics. And specifically in one instance, right, what they really showed is that raising minimum wage doesn't actually hurt employment, which is what we all used to think, but it really raises it. Hmm. So what I'm really highlighting here is that there is a underpinning all the wrangling that we're reading about in Washington and on Capitol Hill is a wholesale rethink here, but also elsewhere, about a more balanced role of regulation to sustain growth, economic growth, and to facilitate, you know, sort of broader based income gains. And that's a significant change from where we've been.
It certainly is. So those are all great. And it just kind of highlights that this is not just about a spending package in Congress right now, that we're talking about much bigger sort of shift in terms of policy. And so let me take you back a little bit more and let's talk a little bit about what we've had over the last decade, which has really been driven by monetary policy, right? And so it seems like there is a little bit of a discussion about how monetary policy can do only so much, and that some of the next phase of you know, proposals or measures we may need to kind of keep us growing are beyond the remit of the of central bankers. I mean, how are you thinking about that? You know, are we sort of seeing a handoff from monetary policy to broader government policy?
In a way. So look, I mean, I feel like so much wrath has been heaped on central bankers recently that I find myself actually defending the institution, which is, you know, a bit of a paradox, right? But look, at the end of the day, you know, sound monetary policy boils down to basically making sure that our economy has sufficient, but not excessive, right, amount of money to undertake all kinds of business activities, which, you know, together accumulate in some type of economic growth, right? So it's a hugely important function, but it's, you know, in a very narrow sense, right? And so for much of the past decade, the burden of adjustment post-GFC fell on monetary policy and the Fed specifically, not because it was the right instrument, right? Or the right institution necessarily, but because it seemed like it was the only government body that was doing something.
Right.
And so at the end of the day, I mean, I think everybody knows, I don't think this is contentious, that neither the Fed nor any other central bank, however competent or otherwise, right, can introduce more competition or can incentivize innovation or can fix our physical and digital infrastructure or can improve the quality of our education and healthcare, right? These are policies that are well outside of remit of monetary policy. And so there's a growing recognition here in the US, but also more broadly, that monetary policy cannot do much to improve income inequality or basically generate or facilitate stronger, sustainably stronger economic growth. And so we must hand off to fiscal policy, not in a narrow sense of, you know, raising taxes and spending, but in the broader sense of affecting all these other areas.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think I want to touch a little bit on how broad, I mean, because I think you and I have talked in the past about how, you know, when we talk about US and China, for example, we are seeing the US try to make sure it's on the offensive and really investing in R&D and the emerging technologies. We're talking about protecting our supply chain situations after what we saw during the pandemic. And a lot of that kind of almost sounds like industrial policy, which we often have associated with places like China. I mean, well, how are you thinking about that kind of a shift in terms of what we're doing here to increase our competitiveness against China, for example?
Sure. That's a great question. And I want to unpack that a little bit. So I want to be clear that, you know, our government has always been quite active. And we've always, we and everyone else for that matter, have always had an active industrial policy, right? It's just that its almost sole preoccupation was focused on improving or safeguarding the near-term profitability of our companies, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not that we haven't had an active government or an active industrial policy. It's just that it's now broadening its scope and shifting away from near-term profitability to broader issues of competitiveness, to broader issues of, you know, securing supply chains and the kinds of innovations that we need to incentivize today that will bear fruit, you know, sometime down the line. So nobody could forecast, right, you know, what 4G technology, what kinds of companies and business models would arise out of that. You know, I don't think anybody predicted the, you know, Uber or, you know, Spotify, right?
Right.
But we know that if we don't invest in 5G today, right, and if we don't incentivize the broadband distribution and the broadly available, you know, very, very high speed, low latency type of connectivity, who knows what kinds of businesses we are foregoing and that China will then have an advantage of in industrial applications and ultimately in healthcare applications.
Yeah, no, it's true. So, I mean, I think all of this raises so many questions about what it means for investors. But before we dive into that, I just want to remind the audience to submit questions in the Q&A function so we can kind of get at those questions as well. But Olga, I mean, I guess as we're shifting or passing the baton or, you know, or whatever we want to, what metaphor we want to use, I mean, what does this mean for investors? Because we go from, you know, central bankers whose entire ethos is to maintain stability to some regard to, you know, the government, which, you know, is obviously rife with politics, much more volatile. I mean, like, what does that mean for investors when they're sort of thinking about their portfolios?
Sure. Well, this is, so anytime you have a shift, right, it does a couple of things. It increases uncertainty. It also has the potential to increase the volatility of the returns. And it also has the potential to unseat, at least partially, right, some of the incumbents whom we mm-hmm. all have grown to, you know, to know and love. And so these are very exciting potentially and you know, nervous times for investors. And I would argue it actually bodes quite well. It highlights the need for more active approach to your, you know, individual or collective investments, right? You know, from my vantage point, the devil is always in the detail, right? The shifts that you and I are talking about are on the one hand very profound, but on the other hand are kind of gradual and cumulative,
right?
So, you know, to take one for example, you know, infrastructure would be unambiguously good, you know, for our economy, right? It would mean cheaper and faster transport and delivery of goods and services. Everybody's on board with that. But if we roll out all the projects all at once, you know, we're not going to have enough, you know, supply of materials or engineers or welders or whatever else you need that goes into building. And so all we're going to end up doing, right, is wasting all of these resources on higher prices. Germany mm-hmm. actually had something similar happen in the last 5 years, where they released all these infrastructure projects all at once and basically just saw construction costs go up by 8 to 10%. Right. So what they've had to do is pull back some of these projects, right, and stagger them so that supply could adjust. Mm-hmm. Something similar is what we're likely to see here. And so as investors, we need to pay attention to what are the sources of inflation and how are they being resolved? Is it unreasonable or unsound policies, or is it about implementing those policies that we need to tweak here and there to ensure a more stable, you know, inflation outcomes, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you mentioned inflation, which I think when I was, you know, reporting this story, that was sort of like the one flaring thing that everyone sort of talked about. Obviously, we're already seeing sort of inflationary pressures because of the supply chain disruptions and the changes to work with labor force and all that. I mean, doesn't this, I hear you in terms of the government has always been more, you know, active underneath the scenes, but it does seem like we're going to kind of see at least a shift in the last, that versus what we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years, where we could see more government spending and government become bigger, you know, force in the economy. So what does that mean for inflation? Like, should we be looking at the same inflation metrics that we usually look at, or, you know, where could the stress points be, especially considering the backdrop that we're coming from?
Well, look, you know, economists can be very fancy about inflation and debate all sorts of things, but at the end of the day, consumers know inflation when they see it. You know, a former Bundesbank governor famously quipped that, you know, I measure inflation by what my housekeeper reports on her way back from the local farmer's market. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, that adage remains true today. A lot of the inflationary pressures that we're seeing today, though, have relatively less to do with increased government spending on a structural basis, much of which we haven't seen yet, by the way. A lot of these things that we're talking about haven't even passed yet.
Yep.
And much more to do with, you know, frankly, the challenges of coordinated reopening post-COVID, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And much of that reopening has not been coordinated. And so the disruption in the supply chains, the disruption in the delivery mechanisms, the you know, many of the people that are reluctant or unable to return to work for a variety of reasons, for example, today in the U.S., you know, economy, we're suddenly missing, you know, by our estimates, about 8.5 million people, right? Yeah. So the natural question is, where have they gone?
Yep.
And when might they be back?
Yep.
And there could be some surprising answers here. For example, a lot of the companies in the construction services are reporting massive labor shortages, right? The transportation mm-hmm. is the same. But what we're actually seeing in the data is that a lot of those former employees have actually incorporated and become, you know, independent contractors. Distribution ship, these folks have started to work for themselves. And you often see that in crisis, entrepreneurship rises.
Yeah.
People that were reluctant to take that leap have done it and are now, you know, kind of enjoying it. And so there's lots of shifts like that, that, you know, this near-term disruption has brought that our economy and others around the world will have to work out. But I would imagine over the next year or so, all of these will largely work themselves out, so that by the time we start to implement some of these more structural packages, like on the infrastructure or on the digital initiatives or the antitrust that we've just begun to talk about, you know, that will have a longer tail and a sort of more benign outlook for things like inflation.
Interesting. So, you know, I have a question here from one audience member, and I think we can maybe even extrapolate it more broadly. So, you know, the person's asking if, you know, the government having a more active role in their business is going to be more costly to fight. And so obviously, initially, you mentioned that sometimes in some relevance, you know, some areas of policy, the incumbents could be at a loss to the startups. But in a situation like this, where costs on businesses could be rising, you know, what is the outlook for smaller businesses who may not have the resources to bear that cost versus larger companies? I'm sure, I mean, where you have like a lot of climate related sort of legislation up in these bills. We also have, you know, childcare and elder care benefits, which of course do great things for some people, but also mean increased costs for employers. I mean, how are you thinking about, I guess, margin pressure more broadly for both small versus large businesses?
So margin pressure is going to be real. It's going to be real for both the incumbents and the starting businesses, so the smaller and the larger. And look, the question is absolutely right, but this is more about how you design a policy and a smart policy design. Of course, we don't have any of those details yet, so it's very difficult to talk specifics. But the point is, we can design things around implementation to make it easier for small businesses to comply. In basically saying, to reduce the burden of compliance on small businesses vis-a-vis the larger ones. And in fact, China, paradoxically, is a good example here. So in September, they finally unveiled their long-anticipated data protection law.
Right.
It's basically an improvement on GDPR out of Europe that we've had, a couple of years ago now. And in it, they specifically put the burden of compliance, a higher level of burden of compliance on much larger companies. And they go through and define what a sufficiently large company is in terms of its use of consumer and industrial data relative to the smaller ones. So that's one example, right, of how you can have a policy that applies to everyone. And you can think about this on the environmental side. So, for example, a much larger company can have a more rigid requirement or a shorter timeframe to comply versus a smaller company. So kind of in proportion to, you know, how much CO2 its activities emit into the atmosphere. So there are lots of ways you can mitigate the impact on margins. Indeed, I would argue one of the things we're trying to do or should be trying to do is to increase more competition, right? To bring about more competition, to increase the prevalence of small and medium-sized firms at the expense of very, very large, few dominant firms, right?
Yeah. That's
what we're trying to do. So we should reduce the burden of compliance then on some of these companies.
Yeah, it is. The devil's in the details. And that is just kind of shifting to China a little bit. I mean, that's obviously what President Xi has been trying to do, you know, amongst other things. He's obviously tightening control over the economy and whatnot. But part of it is targeting this sort of inequality that has kind of really grown over the last decade, both amongst companies, small versus large, and in sort of society. And so, you know, one question we have from Justin is how you think the current administration's policies will sort of impact investors from earning a decent return in, you know, by investing in Chinese companies like DiDi, for example. I mean, what is the outlook, I guess, for Chinese companies, for U.S. investors, you know, allocating money to Chinese companies, given the changes that we're seeing both in China and then also from the U.S.-China standpoint, we're obviously seeing some changes in foreign policy.
Sure. Well, look, these are all really, really good questions with, you can imagine, far-reaching implications. And I imagine we will be discussing these for, you know, for quarters and years to come. Yes. But what's interesting is, you know, for now, paradoxically, U.S. multinationals are actually focusing, the overwhelming majority of them seem to be focusing on generating more business out of China, not decoupling, which is somewhat counterintuitive, right, as compared to the rhetoric that's emanating from, you know, both sides of the Pacific. And from our vantage point as investors, I think the most relevant question here should be, to what extent a particular company's business model rests on continuous innovation and improvement rather than on monopolizing its power to generate excess returns. If you are a monopoly and you're using China because it's underdeveloped or because, you know, this particular product doesn't exist or is not, you know, you don't have enough competition to generate outsized profit margins. And we've seen in the past many, you know, US and European and other corporates generate profit margins that were double or triple, you know, the levels that they were generating in their domestic markets. You know, that is largely not going to be ignored by Chinese leadership. And so we're not going to be able to conduct business in this way. Yeah. But if your business model is all about continuing to innovate, whether radically or incrementally, and to continue to improve, right, the quality of products and services, which, by the way, also means, you know, better for cheaper, you know, China will continue to provide ample opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that, you know, there seems to be a bit of a debate on how investors should be accessing the opportunity in China these days. You know, in the olden days, you know, like maybe 10 years ago, it was definitely the multinationals were the route to go to tap into that growth opportunity, sort of the safer way in. Now it seems like there are more people who are thinking that if you want to be investing in China, you should probably have sort of more direct access to China, in part because of the tensions that we're seeing between the US and China. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Absolutely. I mean, accessibility of returns is a cornerstone of how investable a particular area is, right? At the end of the day, it doesn't matter how strong the growth is. If you can't get to those returns or you can't repatriate them, then,
right,
you know, that's not very attractive. And what's really interesting, and it has flown largely under the radar screen here in the US, maybe somewhat paradoxically, is the efforts that China has been going through to actually open up its capital markets.
Right.
So on the equity side, of course, we have the Hong Kong Connect with, you know, flows both south, north, and the other way around. And more companies are available for investment through that vehicle. And more recently, we have the same thing now on the bond side, on the fixed income side. And this is both for government bonds and corporate bonds.
Right.
So they're actually making, you know, tremendous strides to open up their country for foreign investment in sort of the traditional sense, beyond the brick and mortar, beyond, you know, building factories and other forms, yeah, of FDI. And more, you know, even I think I read this earlier this year. I think this was in January or February of this year, while we're still, you know, massively preoccupied with COVID. They have put a law on the books that first of all, permits foreign owners of their capital to go after domestic companies when they're dealing with bankruptcies.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, this is, again, China's effort. Now, how this is going to be implemented, when, you know, all of these are open questions. But the point is, they are building the legal framework necessary to put foreign investors on the same footing as domestic ones and to incentivize long-term, you know, portfolio and capital flows.
Yeah. I mean, we could talk about China all day. I mean, I think two points I'll just make to what you just said. I mean, obviously China very much needs to have a robust capital market to bolster its own independence if it wants to do that eventually and sort of reduce its dependence on the West. And the other thing is, I think to Justin's question, when I've been talking to money managers increasingly, they've been investing in the Hong Kong listed version of whatever Chinese company versus the ADR, for example, that could potentially get caught in some of the US-China tensions as the SEC looks into potentially delisting some of the companies that don't follow auditing rules.
For
but
sure.
Just one, you know, we're kind of coming into the end of this conversation. So I really definitely want to get back into like how the broader conversation about more government, more policy, more focus on these shifts that you sort of outlined in the beginning. How does that really change asset allocation or portfolios? You know, what should we have more inflation hedges in there? You know, should we rethink the types of multiples we're paying for stocks? Just kind of give me a quick high level version of what, you know, what people should be thinking about as they assemble their portfolios against this backdrop.
We should definitely be thinking about multiples, but more fundamentally, we should think about the business models of the incumbents. Mm-hmm. Are these sustainable? And by extension, are the profit margins sustainable? If so, for how long? Are multiples sustainable? If we begin to see a string of successful blocking of mergers, right, by the authorities, how many more mergers would have happened that now won't happen or won't even come to the market? How many new companies will be allowed to become, you know, public? We've seen, I mean, you know this better than I do probably, you know, the number of actively listed companies in the U.S., you know, publicly listed has basically halved. We're somewhere in the order of 3,500 today, down from, you know, 6,000, what seemed like yesterday, right?
Are we
going to see a change in that trend? Are we going to see more new listings? Are we going to see them in more diverse areas? Are our returns going to become broader and come from more interesting areas? Today, the returns in the S&P 500, as you know, are very highly concentrated. Is that going to broaden out? And what does that mean for the discrepancy in multiples, right, that we're seeing from the very, very strongest earners to everyone else? Those are the shifts that we're looking at and thinking about.
Yeah. And those are major shifts that I think, you know, even if we think about some of the other themes that are kind of pervading the backdrop here in the market, where we are in terms of, market levels and valuations on sort of the mega cap tech companies, for example, and the regulatory scrutiny that they're facing, it all sort of ties together to some sort of a rotation of sorts, right? We seem to be at an inflection point on many different fronts is kind of what I hear you saying.
Basically. And I mean, even taxes, right? It's tempting to say, oh, you know, corporate tax bill is going up and that means, you know, lower profit margins. Okay, sell. But that's a little simplistic, right? You know, what are the offsets here? If the large multinationals now have to pay more, how many fewer lawyers, accountants, you know, whoever else are they employing to dodge those taxes? You know, how much of that activity will become redundant? And how much less of a burden will other smaller companies and households have to shoulder? In other words, how much of an offset will there be in stronger growth?
Yeah. There's so many different puts and takes on this. And I think that that's one of the other takeaways I got that, you know, when we talk about sort of the infrastructure bill or some of these spending packages, there's that knee jerk reaction and certain stocks and certain industries do well, right, with infrastructure. But it doesn't seem like the market has necessarily taken through the indirect, the second and third order derivatives of what comes out of this, right? So how much of all of this sort of shift do you think has been factored into the market given where we are right now and in the sectors that are doing well?
Oh, very little. Reshma, I'm not the world's most knowledgeable baseball fan, but we haven't even started the game. So it's premature to say that we're top of the first inning here.
We really haven't
even started. And the reason, and you kind of outlined the crux of the challenge here, right? You see the disruption of new policies in the form of, you know, upstaging the current patterns and upstaging the current disruptors or disrupting the incumbents. You see that first, right?
Right.
Before the positive changes, you know, come through, and those are still highly uncertain. And it's the same, you know, just to go full circle and to show that what we've experienced in China is not too dissimilar to what's happening here is, you know, they did the same thing. They've unseated or trying to unseat the incumbents first. And that's much more destructive first before we get into the growth and the building and the improving opportunity part of the equation. And that's always the challenge with a lot of these policies, which is why historically in the U.S. they've been very slow to take off.
That's true. I mean, I cover China very closely, and often people have pointed to China as perhaps a harbinger of what we could see in obviously in a different way. We're not the same system and all that for sure.
No, but, do we know, want-
right, exactly. But there's the regulatory shifts that we're seeing and sort of changing the playing field to some extent. But I guess is there anything to kind of just the last thought here is there anything that you're telling your clients at this point in time in terms of their portfolios on the basis of this? Because there is so much uncertainty out there. So is there anything in terms of volatility or the like that you suggest our readers should also be thinking about as they think about their portfolios into the year end?
As we're much longer term focused than, one month or one quarter, but generally, laser focus on peaking growth and peaking margins in the near term. And if you are finding businesses that are in fact able to sustain or even accelerate from current trends, rather than go back to pre-COVID levels of activity, those are really the ones you want to pay attention to and overweight.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Olga. This was so great. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to the audience for tuning in. Thanks, Olga, for your always insightful thoughts. We hope you listen to our next episode tomorrow. MarketWatch retirement reporter Alessandro Melito and Ari Parker, head advisor and co-founder of Chapter, will discuss the upcoming open enrollment period for Medicare. Learn the best tips for maximizing your coverage, the risks associated with the wrong or no plan, and how many options you may have available. Thanks for listening. Be well and stay safe.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.